the play itself will tell you much more about sort of the domestic side of his life, and that's why it's called A Marriage. It really is about Leo and Sonia, and you'll hear both of their perspectives on that relationship. The play begins in 1862, the year they get married, with Leo and Sonia courting. And we will, and I will announce at various times during the play the year it is, so you'll sort of get a feeling of the passage of time. I'm David Klein, and I will be reading the part of Leo. Luke McCree will be reading the part of Sonia. Rob Cole is reading the part of Ilya, who was one of their children. Sarah Stewart is reading the part of Tanya, who was one of their daughters. Though in a sense, the two, Ilya and Tanya, stand for all of their children. I think there's material from letters of several of the children combined together into one part. There were, I think, 13 children born to them, of whom 9 survived past term. And Clancy Dunnigan is playing Chepkov, who was one of Tolstoy's most fervent disciples and also wound up publishing many of his works, translating them, and getting them disseminated all over the world, particularly his later political works. So,
David asked me when we were rehearsing this morning to give you a gentle bit of advice. Since these are drawn from diaries and from different portions of diaries, I would suggest that you tend to listen to it more almost as a musical piece. I mean, it is linear, but there are sometimes sudden shifts in it, and so don't be disturbed by that. Just simply go with what's coming, and don't try to necessarily hook it too tightly together sometimes.
Okay. Sometimes it's been hard for us to figure out the script exactly. So one of the reasons we want to read it is our group Playworks has often has done some other work of Tolstoy, so we're sort of interested in thinking about whether or not we might want to do it. So sort of dragged it up and said, let's try it out at Holden and see what it looks like. So anybody wants to stay afterwards, we'd like to chat with you about it and see what you got from it and get your impressions of it. Act 1, 1862. It delights me that my first thought this morning is of you, and that I sit down to write to you, not to keep a promise, but because I want to. All the way here, your favorite, the foolish man, was completely out of hand. He gibbered and grinned and made absurd plans. I began to be afraid of him. He kept remembering your whispery voice and the way you hop up and down when you dance and your bad temper when you were casting your line at Drummond Pond wearing those enormous knitted boots. The foolish man wanted to rush back to say a lot of foolish things to you and never leave you again. But his friend, the good man, whom you don't like, said to the foolish man, "You are lying when you say you are happy with her. It is true you feel pleasure in listening to her, in looking into her eyes, but that isn't happiness. Beauty you can get to know and love in an hour and stop loving just as quickly. But the soul takes a long time to know and love."
"I still like the foolish man, and I wish you would listen more to him. I like to laugh, I like to flirt. You have to love me as I am."
"I need to know you first so that I can love you. You must not hide things from me. For 3 days you teased me with your little secret. I wasn't joking when I said there must be no secrets. If my wife were to make a surprise for me, something trivial as a cushion, and keep it a secret from me, I would run away from her the next day. Do you think you can live with such a monster?"
"Sometimes I find him so old, boring, selfish. But there are other times, and they are not rare, that I am sick in love with him."
"Do you think I couldn't do what you do? Melt like a noodle?" "My special feeling for you that I have for no one else is this. As soon as anything bad happens to me, a failure, a blow to my self-esteem, I remember you and I think, it doesn't matter. I have Sonia. It's a pleasant feeling."
"It hurts me to look at him, to be near him, as it must hurt a devil to be near a saint."
"Come now, dinner is waiting."
"I'm not hungry. It's so lovely here."
"How simple and clear you are."
"We had better go in or they will come looking for us."
"No, wait. Sonia, can you make out what I am writing here? I'll write only the first letter of each word.
I watched his big reddish hand and felt my entire soul, all my energy and attention focused on that piece of chalk and the hand guiding it. He wrote, Y-Y-A, Y-T-F-H-R-M-C-O-M-A-A-T-I-H-F-M. I can't. Your youth and your thirst for happiness remind me cruelly of my age and the impossibility of happiness for me.
Amazing.
I felt solemn and happy, and something I had never known before, something infinite.
She is a child, or certainly looks like one. I am afraid of myself. What if it is only the desire to love again and not love itself? I insisted she let me read her diary. Expressions in it like unattractive, inconsistent, hit me hard. I am 34 years old, got up with my usual feeling of depression, shaved my ugly mug. It is no longer love or jealousy or regret or anything I have ever known. It is very sweet, like a bit of hope mixed with sorrow. Good, comfortable feeling. Her voice is sad, peaceful.
Haven't you ever been in love before?
I want to laugh. I am suddenly wildly happy. Toothless old fool that I have fallen in love. Did not sleep all last night. So clear was the picture I was painting of my happiness. In the evening, we talked of love, from bad to worse. There is nothing in her of what I have always seen in the other, soulfulness, the little tricks.
His expression is so gentle, so humble, the eyes of a saint.
Don't go chasing poetry and beauty and love. There are cadets for that, old man. That's not true. I keep thinking one day she will be here with me and we will be reading this together. I am in love and I did not believe it possible to be. I am insane. I shall put a bullet in my head if this goes on much longer. Lord, help me. 4 in the morning. I have written her a letter which I shall give her tomorrow. That is, today. God, I am afraid I shall die. Such happiness isn't possible. Help me, my God. Sonia Andreevna, the situation has become intolerable. Every day for 3 weeks I have sworn to myself, today I shall speak, and every day I leave you with the same anguish, the same regret, the same terror, the same joy in my heart. I am bringing this letter with me to give to you in case I lack the opportunity or the courage to speak. Tell me truthfully, do you want to be my wife? Don't say yes unless you are absolutely sure. If you have the shadow of a doubt, then it is better to say no. If you do say no, it will be awful for me. But I am expecting it and shall find the strength to bear it. Well?
Of course.
Wedding night. Innkeeper opened up the Tsar's chambers. Rain. Coaches stopping. Doors slammed, grooms cursed. She knows all now, simple. Her terror, something morbid. Immense happiness. It is impossible that this should end except with life itself. It is 2 weeks now, I feel clean. Living with another person makes such a difference, it's almost frightening. One feels life so intensely. Every second is in earnest. She's reading this, doesn't understand a thing.
He's mistaken. I understand everything, absolutely everything that concerns him.
You see?
It's lonely here. We were so lively at home. Here, when Leo is away, it's like death. He's always lived alone, so he doesn't understand. He makes me sick with his peasants. He's going to have to choose between me and these peasants he loves so much. It's selfish of me? Well, too bad. I live for him and by him, and I want it to be the same for him. If I'm only a plaything, not a human being, then I neither can nor will go on living like this.
She doesn't realize how much she has changed my life. She has changed me far more than I have changed her.
He loves me just the way he loves nature. His precious peasants, even his writing, one after the other. Then when the craze passes, he loves something else.
I love her more and more. Today, after 7 months, a feeling of humility came over me. I saw her as good and pure and virginal. I feel I do not possess her, even though she gives me all of herself. I do not possess her because I am not worthy. That is why my happiness isn't complete. Something keeps tormenting me.
When he embraces me, I know I am not the first person he has crushed to him. It is bitter and painful to think that my saintly husband is just like the rest of the world.
I love her when at night or early in the morning I wake up and find her looking tenderly at me. I love her when she is sitting close to me and we both are feeling that we love each other with all our strength. And when, after we have been silent for a long time, I finally say, "Well, Sonia, what should we do now?" And she laughs. I love her when she is angry at me and suddenly widens her eyes and tries to look mean and snarls.
Leave me alone.
And the next minute, she is smiling shyly at me. I love to see her head thrown back, her face solemn and frightened.
I have a wild desire to escape. I am surrounded by dry rot. Everyone I see is old. Leo keeps wagging his finger at me and saying, "That's enough."
You are so pure and shy, I am ashamed to let you see me as I am. But nothing must be hidden, so you must read these diaries. Here it all is, my gambling, my toothaches and diarrheas, my chasing after women.
Please, no. I don't need to.
There must be no secrets. Read them.
In love as I have never been before. And with whom? A fat peasant, a vulgar woman with greasy white skin, and she's still living in this house. I dreamed I was arguing with her. She was insolent. She wore a black silk dress. Furious, I seized the child in her arms and I tore off its arms, its legs, and its head. I was in a frenzy. Leo came in. He picked up the scattered pieces and comforted me. He told me it was only a doll. And I looked. And it was only strips of deer skin and wads of cotton. If only I could bury his diary and his past with it.
Suddenly at 10 p.m. on the 21st of March, 1863, this extraordinary thing happened. On that day, I got up early and did a lot of walking and writing. We had supper together. I was happy and at peace. At 10 o'clock, I went up to bed. I heard her opening the door, breathing, getting undressed, all in my sleep. I heard her coming out from behind the screen and walking toward the bed. I opened my eyes and saw Sonia, but a Sonia made of china. A little china doll with cold, bare shoulders and neck and hair painted black, and with protruding china eyes also painted black at the edges. I said, "Are you made of china?" She replied without opening her lips, "Yes, I am." I began to touch her. She was all smooth china, pleasant to touch, but cold. I took hold of her and tried to carry her over to the bed. My fingers made no impression on her cold china body. Suddenly I heard her voice. "Leo, why have I become china?" I didn't know what to say. She said, "Does it matter that I am china?" I didn't want to upset her, and I said it didn't. I felt her again in the darkness. She was still cold, still china. Yet her belly was the same as when she was alive, still protruding upwards like a comb, and rather unnatural for a china doll. Now, whenever we are alone, the same thing happens. When she is with others, she is normal.
I have ceased to exist for Leo. I can give him no joy since I am pregnant. He resents my weakness as though it were my fault. Yesterday I ran through the garden. I wanted to start a miscarriage. But nature is strong as steel.
The doctor said, "You have a son." I saw a strange reddish creature with a big soft head. I had to make an enormous effort to believe that Sonia was still alive, that she was all right, that this wailing baby was my son. Why this child? Who was he? Where did he come from?
Leo says it's monstrous not to nurse one's child. Well, who says it isn't? But it is physically impossible. God knows I tried. It was excruciating. My breasts were fissured. He would banish me from the earth because I am suffering, and I cannot bear him because he is not suffering. Just writing about it. I shall certainly take care of my son and do everything I can, but not because of Leo or his scorn.
I know that I have many failings, but I thought I had at least a little kindness. Yet I have been boorish and cruel, and to whom? To the one creature who gives me happiness, who alone loves me. Sonia, I know how hard it is to forgive such cruelties, but there is a good man inside me, though he is often asleep. Love him, Sonia. We patched things up, but kisses are just false plasters. After dinner, the plaster cracked. Tears, fits of nerves. It's hard for me to stay home with her. She is unhappy. But I am still more unhappy and can say nothing to help her. Besides, there is nothing to say.
Leo has seen fit to impress upon me that he cannot be content with family life. He needs other distractions.
Where is my old self? I have become trivial, and all because of marriage to a woman I love. Nearly every word I write is a lie. The thought that she is there reading over my shoulder stifles sincerity. I have to add words for her. What I write is not so much untrue as just different from what I would say if I were writing for myself alone. 1 o'clock in the morning already, and I can't sleep at all, much less in the room with her. She begins to whine and moan as soon as she knows someone is listening. Just now she is snoring peacefully away. She will wake up absolutely convinced that she is the most unfortunate woman alive. It is time to take my sword down from its rusty nail and offer my services again to the Tsar.
Tomor, what is this latest whim? This irresponsibility? No, it's instability. Everything in him is flux. Today, he gets married, the idea appeals to him, he has children. Tomorrow, this life does not suit me, and off he gallops to the wars. I don't understand such childish enthusiasms in a man of 35. If a child would just die, then I could too. I don't want to live without Leo. The wind changed. The war shifted to the Balkans. Leo prefers to fight the Turks. He didn't go. He wrote about it instead. The reviews are full of praise. Leo Tolstoy's new book, The Cossacks, is neither a novel nor reporting. It is, however, a tremendous achievement in Russian literature, able to sustain comparison with the greatest books of the last decade.
I have never felt my mental and even moral powers so strong. I am ready for work, and the work is taking shape. All this autumn, I have been completely taken up with a novel about the years from 1810 to 1820.
He is working on a story about 1812. He is very involved in it, but without enjoyment. It's about Countess So-and-so, who is talking to Princess What's-it, insignificant. As I copy the work, impressions swarm through my mind. Nothing affects me as strongly as his ideas, his talent. This has been true for only a short time. Have I changed? Or is this book so very good? I copy quickly enough to keep pace with the action and slowly enough to think over. Be, weigh, judge every one of Leo's ideas.
I remember your saying to me that all the military and historical parts over which I am taking such pains will turn out badly. But the rest, the family life, the characters, the psychology, will be good. That couldn't be more true.
Turgenev says, quote, there are passages that will live as long as the Russian language. Tolstoy is a giant among his fellow writers, an elephant in our menagerie. War and Peace is incoherent, absurd even, but immense, and so intelligent.
I'm borrowing 1,000 rubles. I know you'll be angry with me for borrowing, but please try not to be. I am doing it to be free and untroubled in money matters. I intend to save the money as much as possible and to keep it simply in order to know that there is money available.
I have taken over the management of the estate, even of the household accounts. Leo must not be distracted.
Our marriage has grown stronger and steadier. We love each other, We have no secrets and no shame. Not one person in a million is as happy as we are together.
Are there any couples more united and happier than we? Sometimes when I'm alone in my room, I begin to laugh, and then I cross myself. He is sometimes too demanding. I told him today I was not going to be a nanny, even to a great man. He stormed out. But when he came back, everything was light and easy. He smelled of fresh air. He himself was like fresh air.
It is no longer love, but a fusion of souls so complete that we could not go on living without each other.
I will soon have been married for 6 years. And my love continues to grow. We still argue, but the causes of our quarrels are so deep and complicated that they could not occur if we did not love each other as we do. I still love him with the same passionate, jealous, romantic love with which I loved when I was 18. Sometimes his assurance and self-possession annoy me.
1872. Tanya is 8. Everyone says she resembles Sonia, and I agree. Not just because I like to think so, but because it is obviously so. Had she been Adam's firstborn, and had there been no others after her, she would have been an unhappy little girl. Her greatest pleasure is looking after the younger ones. She takes a physical pleasure in holding and touching a little body. Her dream is to have children. The other day I took her to the city. She begged me to buy a little knife for Sergei, something for this one, something for that. She knows just what will give each one of them the greatest pleasure. I bought nothing for her, and not for one moment did she think of herself. As we were driving home, I asked, Tanya, are you asleep?
No, Papa.
What are you thinking about?
I was thinking about how when we get home, I'll ask Mama whether Ilya has been good, and give him his present, and give the others theirs, and how Sergei will pretend he's not pleased, but he will be very pleased.
Ilya has never been sick. Big boned, fair, beaming, bad at lessons. Always thinks about what he's been told not to think about. Invents his own games. Mind is very important to him. Hot-tempered and violent, quick to fight, but also tender and extremely sensitive. Sensuous, fond of eating and lying down in comfort. When he eats currant jelly and buckwheat cakes, his lips tremble. When he cries, he becomes furious. But when he laughs, everyone laughs with him. Not long ago, when I was writing children's stories, he made up one of his own.
Once a boy was watching the rain come down. He asked out loud, "Does God pee?" And God made that boy pee all the time.
Everything depends on Mama. She gives orders to the cook. She sends us out for walks. Mends our stockings and our clothes. Makes our skirts. Yells at us when we get our shoes wet. She copies everything that Papa writes. She's the only one who can read his writing. She copied War and Peace 8 times. Even when we get up in the middle of the night, she's at her desk copying. She knows about things. She knows that we must wash every day, have soup for dinner, learn to talk French, everything.
Papa sits across from Mama at the dinner table. He has his own very special round spoon. Whenever we have jelly pudding, he tells us that it is good for gluing boxes.
This makes Mama very cross.
He rides a horse better than anyone. He rides faster than anyone. He is stronger than anyone in the world. He doesn't punish us, but when he looks into my eyes, he knows everything that I am thinking. It is scary. We can fool Mama, but not Papa. No one ever lies to him.
He knows all our secrets. When we played house under the lilac bush, we had 3 secrets with nobody but Ilya and Sergei, and I knew. One day, Papa said he knew all our secrets, and they all began with B. It was true. The first was that Mama was going to have a baby. The second was that Sergei was in love with a baron. And the third was, I don't remember.
Mama makes jam in the garden, under the linden trees. There is a smell of coal from the burning brazier. The jam bubbles thickly and rises in the pink foam. Bees and wasps swarm around it. It smells so good we can hardly wait for the taste of the skim.
It's for tea. You can't have any now. It would spoil your appetite.
Just a taste?
I said no.
But in the end, We get not only the skim, but a little of the jam, too.
In the summer, we won in the raised high grass. No, not grass. It is almost all flowers. Yellow, pink, red, blue, white. The mowing has begun. The hay gives off a sleepy smell. Village girls bring wooden bowls filled with white mushrooms and wild strawberries. They pour them out onto a stone or a platter. More fragrances, more perfumes.
My father has never held me, or petted me, or kissed me. It isn't that he doesn't love me. I know he loves me. But he never touches me, or tells me. He calls people who do that sort of thing sentimentalists.
If we want sympathy or feel like Bali, we run to Mama.
In autumn, life becomes much more sober. Leo sits behind a stack of books and portraits and pictures, frowning, reading, taking notes. In the evening, when the children are in bed, he tells me what he hopes to write. He's chosen the period of Peter the Great. I think it's going to be another epic like War and Peace.
I am depressed and write nothing. You can't imagine how difficult I find this preparatory work. I have to think and rethink everything that might happen to hundreds of people in a world that actually existed 2 centuries ago, which I am actually creating anew. I have to think over millions of possible combinations in order to choose the precisely right one.
Today, for the first time, he began to write. I cannot understand what is going on in his head during the hours when he produces nothing. Sometimes he thinks he is losing his mind. His fear of insanity is so intense it terrifies me.
I was traveling into the steppes to buy land. I stopped at an inn in a village of cramped houses. The innkeeper had a sore on one cheek that was somehow horrible to me. I had a sense of foreboding as I entered my room. The doors and woodwork were painted dark red, the color of dried blood. The room was square. I was disturbed by the fact that it was perfectly square. I stretched out on the sofa. I awoke a short time later in an empty, black, unfamiliar room, rancid with burned-out tallow candles. Why am I so depressed? What am I so afraid of? It was death who answered, of me. My whole being ached with the need to live, the right to be alive, and at the same time I felt death at work in me. Everyone else was asleep, snoring, it was awful. I felt cold, dry, mean. There was not one drop of goodness in me, only a hard, calm anger against myself. Death was entering every pore of my skin, weakening and rotting my organs, binding my tongue, darkening my brain.
Last evening, Leo suddenly announced, I have written a sheet and a half, and I think it's coming right. I assumed that he was trying to start up Peter the Great again for the 18th time, so I didn't pay much attention. But then he told me that he has begun a novel on the private lives of contemporary people. It's about an unfaithful wife, Anna.
We're going through a family crisis. Peter was born with water on the brain. In the last 4 months, he has gone through every phase of the disease. My wife feeds him herself. Part of the time, she is in despair, thought he is going to die. Part of the time, she is in terror that he may live and remain an idiot. The child is dead. I am deeply worried for my wife. For her, it is awful.
He died peacefully. I nursed him 14 1/2 months. He lived from June 13, 1872 to November 9, 1873. A gay, healthy child. I loved him so much. They buried him yesterday. What an emptiness now. I cannot reconcile the image of Peter alive and Peter dead. They are both precious to me, but what attached to me? Did it hurt him to leave me?
Sonia? Sonia? Sonia?
Where are you? What's wrong, Leomochka?
Nothing, nothing. I didn't have any matches. I came out of the study, there was no light, I got lost. I suddenly couldn't remember where I was. What were those walls? Where did those steps go, Sonia?
At last we are writing Anna Karenina for good, without interruptions. Leo is tense and excited. He writes another chapter every day, and I copy feverishly.
No, let me hurry and finish this book so that I can start another. To be good, a book has to have a central idea that you love. In Anna Karenina, I love the idea of the family. In War and Peace, I love the idea of the people.
There are queues lining up in every bookstore in Moscow. No one talks of anything but our book.
What is so difficult about describing how an army officer gets entangled with a married woman? It's not only trivial, it's bad.
I need gaiety, chatter, elegance. I would like to be admired, to hear people tell me that I am beautiful. I never thought I was, but now there seems to be so little time before I am old. Much good it would be do me to be beautiful. My babies would love their plain old mamma just as much as they would love a great beauty. And Leo would have grown accustomed to the ugliest woman alive. If only she always did what he told her to. I feel like curling my hair. Nobody would see me, but it would be pretty. After writing that, I feel like crying.
We have pink radishes on the table, beautiful yellow butter, plump golden bread on a white tablecloth. Our ladies in their muslin gowns are so happy, sitting among the green plants in the garden. But beyond that hedge, the drought covers the dusty fields with weeds, crazes the soil, sears the soles of the peasants' feet, splits the horses' hooves.
He groans and goes all day on his horse and shuts himself into the study at night. If only he could begin to write again.
All right, so you own 5,000 acres of land. You will be more famous than Gogol, Pushkin, Shakespeare, Molière, all the writers in the world. And then what? You can't stop. And you can't close your eyes to the fact that at the end there is nothing. Then I hear laughter. Someone has worked everything out a long time ago and is laughing at me. That someone is enjoying himself, watching how, after cultivating my body and mind for 40 years, here I stand like an idiot, realizing there is nothing and never will be anything in life. And he thinks it's funny. As I undress, I look at the crossbar between the two cabinets loaded with books. It would hold my weight. A slipknot, a chair kicked away, a body that jerks, sways back and forth, stops. No more Leo Tolstoy. So I have removed the rope from the room and I have stopped taking my gun along on the walk. 1878.
Something in us has broken. I've lost my faith in happiness and life.
I am revolted by everything I have written. All that I have published I'll be scratched out, thrown away. The question of the soul is the only question. In this world there are heavy people, wingless ones, who lurch about in the muck. Then there are men who let their wings grow, who rise slowly from the earth and soar above it. Then there are men with broad, powerful wings who alight in the thick of the human crowd for the sheer pleasure of it. When the crowd tears out their feathers and breaks their bones, they try to thrust upward with their crippled wings but collapse back to earth. I am one of those. When my wings will heal, I shall fly very high, and God help me.
I don't understand what Papa wants anymore. I used to. It pleased him when I first swam the river. And when I climbed up on my horse, Danger. He didn't say anything, but I could tell. Now he looks at me as though I disappoint him or disgust him.
Papa and Mama are always quarreling. Papa seems so alone.
His eyes are strange and staring. He hardly speaks. He seems to be not of this world.
He never jokes anymore. He's like someone out of the Bible. When we are playing an amateur play, playing croquet, or just talking foolishness, everybody is happy, chatting away, Papa appears, and with one word, or even one look, spoils everything. We feel somehow ashamed.
It is all very clear, and God willing, what I write now will be very important.
He has changed. He has become the most fanatical Christian. He is pale, his health is poor, he is subdued, somber. You used to worry because you had no faith. Why are you so miserable now that you have it?
The family is another temptation. It is a second physical body. Abandon it. Live not for the family, but for God.
You can't leave your children half educated. You have to feed them, clothe them, take care of them. The village children run about without ever washing. They herd sheep at 10. They plow at 13. Is that what you want for yours?
The village children are taught to work. Our children can't go for a swim in the river without shouting for someone to harness up the horses to take them there.
Oh, it must be wonderful to be so holy that you don't care what happens to your own children. Most of us can't be that holy. Well, maybe it's that we don't try to hide the fact that we really can't love anyone by pretending that we love everyone.
You are like a bear cuffing at anyone who would take food from her cubs. But don't you see they are feeding off the heart's blood of others? I care about their souls. This life we lead is wrong.
When a man starts saying everything is loathsome, when he won't see anything good anywhere, that man is sick. I don't say this to argue with you or to hurt you. You need treatment. Have you only now discovered that there are starving, sick, wicked, miserable people in this world? Look again. There are cheerful, healthy, happy, and good people too. As for me, what am I supposed to do? You don't need me. You don't need my love anymore.
You say to me, you don't need my love anymore. On the contrary, that is all I need. I cannot live without you. Your presence is absolutely necessary to me.
Sometimes I find this cloistered existence stifling. Since last September, I have not set foot outside the house. It is a prison. I feel as though someone is fencing me and shutting me away. I want to knock everything down and smash everything around me and run away somewhere, but quickly, quickly.
I went out this morning at 11 o'clock and was intoxicated by the freshness of the morning. It was warm and dry. The grass was coming up everywhere in blades or clumps from under the leaves and straw. The lilacs were in bud. The birds were no longer singing at random, but were talking to one another. And in the quiet, round the corners of the house and all around the dung heap, the bees were buzzing. It was very good.
I spend all my time embroidering a rug in silence or reading. I feel nothing but coldness and indifference toward everyone and everything. It is all tedious and sad. And ahead lies darkness.
Here we stand, staring at each other, each blaming the other. I must get away from you.
I will never forget those words. I want to die. I can't live without his love. There's no way that I can prove that I have loved him for 20 years, and as deeply now as on the first day. My love just irritates him. He is so obsessed with his self-perfection. This morning I went to bathe in the river, and it was a glorious morning, light and cool. The dew made everything silver. I dove into the black water, and I longed to keep going down, down. I would like to have died then. I didn't even catch cold.
I used to think it unfair that I should not be allowed to see the fruits of my labor. Now it is clear to me that what a man does out of love, without reaping any reward, is the work of God.
He is wasting his time in foolishness, learning Hebrew like a seminarian. He is throwing away his career. It's a shame, it's a shame.
What I do will not be truly good until I am no longer around to spoil it.
He is working, writing articles. He seems very calm.
I have no completely absorbing work in progress.
He is a man ahead of his time. He marches in front of the crowd and shows the way it must follow. And I am one of the crowd. I see the light in Leo, but I say, yes, there is the light. But I can't walk any faster.
I am painfully sensitive to the life around me and to my own life. They are both repulsive.
It is too bad that I won't be confined before summer. I should so like to get the ghastly thing over with before then. It's the best season, swimming, haying, long, long days, moonlit nights. And I'll be spending it in bed with a squalling baby, my 12.
She is obsessed with her pregnancy. It is a great sin, a shame. I went for a walk. I saw some struggle going on. I heard a policeman shout, "Take them away!" I asked what was going on. They picked up some prostitutes. Three were taken away, but one was drunk and dropped behind. She was a girl with the same build as my 13-year-old Masha. She wore a filthy, torn dress. The policeman yelled, "I'll let you have it, you bitch!" I asked her how old she was. In a hoarse, drunken voice, she said, 16. They took her away. I didn't take her home, didn't give her a meal, didn't do anything at all for her. In the morning, I went to the police station, but they had already sent her away. When I reached home, a man who does some copying for me burst in. He said, "The terrible thing has happened. A laundress lived in our house. She was too sick to work. She hadn't any money. The landlady turned her out. She stood on the steps. She wouldn't go away. The landlady called the policeman. He dragged her away. She screamed, 'Where can I go?' He said, 'You can die where you like, but you can't live without money,' and set her down in a church porch. In the evening, she started to crawl back to our rooming house, but she didn't make it. She died on the steps. I walked back to the rooming house with him. There was a coffin in the cellar, and in the coffin was a barely clothed woman with a stiff leg bent at the knee. Wax candles burned. The deacon was reading a sort of requiem. I'd gone out of curiosity. I am ashamed to write this, ashamed to live. At home, the fifth course, the sturgeon, was found to be not quite fresh. My talk about this with my own family was greeted with bewilderment.
Why talk about it when you can't put it right?
That is when I prayed, God, teach me how to exist, how to live so that my life shall not be loathsome to me. I am waiting for him to teach me. Okay, that's the end of the first. That's when I take a 2-minute break, stretch for a second, and then we'll read Act 2.